Hi everyone, welcome back to Birdwatching. This is a podcast about the cultural legacy and impact of the crow, and I am your host, Randy. And today we will be discussing, breaking down, getting into The Crow Salvation, the third crow film to be released, the first direct-to-video, and maybe a less explored entry into this story. The Crow Salvation marks a departure from the rest in the series, mainly that it's the first direct-to-video sequel, and also in that it's the first one I find very little redeeming qualities in, and I would just like to get this out of the way immediately. I do not care for this film. And as I do anytime I cover something I am not particularly fond of for this show, I would like to reiterate, this is not a personal attack or a judgment of character on anyone who worked on Salvation. Movies are so hard to make. It's just my personal take that this one is not for me. I am going to examine it as objectively as I can and see what it adds to this canon, but this is not one that I come back to very often. Here is the plot summary to The Crow Salvation. I will do my best. In Salt Lake City, Alexander, Alex Frederick Corvus, is framed for the murder of his girlfriend, Lauren Randall, and sentenced to death. 3 years later, after the sentencing, he is executed in the electric chair. He is, of course, brought back to life by a crow and given supernatural abilities, and is brought back to avenge Lauren's death. Alex follows this crow and finds evidence that Lauren was killed by a group of corrupt cops, including one that has a scar on his arm that he recognizes as one he saw on somebody in the crowd before his execution. Later, he encounters Erin, Lauren's sister, who believes that he is guilty, and Alex is like, "No, I'm not, and I'll prove it." Alex finds a witness in the trial who was bribed to give perjured testimony and forces this witness to confess that four members of the police force killed Lauren. And then Alex starts picking off the cops, of course. He finds out that Erin and Lauren's father, Nathan, is in business with the corrupt cops and is indirectly responsible for Lauren's death, because Lauren found out that he was in business with them. Erin runs in horror when is confronted with this truth. And then Erin confesses to Alex that she felt guilty for Lauren's murder because she told the cops where they could find her, thinking that they would only arrest Alex. With his crow powers, Alex shows Erin that Lauren fought off her attackers and that Erin should forgive herself. When Erin returns home, she finds out that her father has killed himself out of remorse, and Alex finds out from his lawyer while he was alive, that one of Nathan's businesses was revealed to be a front for a drug smuggling operation, and Lauren had witnessed someone kill a guy in this club, leading to her death. So she was in the wrong place at the wrong time, which is something the later Crow films really seem to rely on as a plot device. The other two or three cops, there's like a plot twist that there's a fifth cop who's also involved, but it's not the dad, which, whatever. So anyway, the other three cops kidnap Erin, and Alex starts a fight at the club, because this is a crow movie and we must have a fight at a club. The crow leaves Alex after he has fulfilled his duty here, killing the remaining police officers, but Alex isn't done yet. From a clue left behind in the scene, Alex deduces that the head of this group is still alive, and he heads to the police station to kill him, but without his powers, he is stabbed and dies from his wounds. Alex begins to believe he caused Lauren's death and accepts his own. But they bring Alex's body to a room where Erin is tied with her mouth stitched shut, and Erin manages to drop Lauren's locket, and the crow drops it next to Alex, because this locket was, like, vaguely in a couple flashback scenes, and it's, like, you know, a symbol of their love and whatnot, and it revives Alex and allows him to set Erin free and kill the remaining cops. He finds the cop with a scar. Alex and Erin electrocute the last cop in the electric chair, a la Alex's own death. And then Alex's soul is finally released to reunite with Lauren, and Erin keeps the necklace. If it sounds like I was struggling to read all of that, That's because I was. I had to edit down the Wikipedia synopsis, which is far longer than it has any right to be. And that's probably my most, like, pressing problem with The Crow's Salvation is there's an overabundance of bad guys and very few likable, not insanely evil characters with which to combat that. Like, of course, the bad guys in Crow movies are, like, cartoonishly evil. That's, like, the point. But there's also other sympathetic characters that we follow whose lives may not be, you know, being avenged currently, but are good characters in a world that maybe our returned character also cares about. There's only one of those in this story. It is Aaron. And to that end, the movie also sort of paints itself into a corner by having the only sympathetic person left alive for our Crow to hang out with, for lack of a better word, is that it's the sister of his romantic partner. So whereas in the last film we did have that sort of will they, won't they with Sarah and Ash, there is a sort of like, this relationship is very strange, it's very antagonistic, but also not. And, like, it feels like they needed a Sarah and a Shelley at the same time, and they kind of did neither with Kirsten Dunst's character. Also just insane that it's Kirsten Dunst. This film is almost an entirely different beast. Rob Zombie's directorial debut was originally slated to be a Crow film, and it would have been released in place of this. I talk more about it on my Roads Not Taken episode, about all the various reboots of The Crow that have been canceled over the years. Rob Zombie's film would have been a big departure in a way that this one isn't. The script for it is still floating around, and I do recommend giving it a read. It's super interesting. Very Rob Zombie, as, you know, you would expect. Ed Pressman and Jeff Most, the producers who have made all of these Crow movies, were sort of uncomfortable with how much it leaned away from the formula and ultimately decided not to go with it. And Rob was very frustrated with having to cater to the producer's whims, which he said changed pretty often throughout the process of writing his script. So they eventually ditched it. They also wanted to cater to more of a teen audience with this film, and Eric Mabeus certainly comes off as a very young Crow, and there is a sort of juvenile element to this film that also maybe doesn't work for as dark and violent as it chooses to get at times as well. This film also carries on the weird theme of, like, weird sex clubs and weird sex crimes. There is a pretty explicit almost rape scene of two women by one of the cops that gets killed, which is, like, yes, this is The Crow, but it's also way more explicit than it's ever been in any of the other films. A lot of blood, like, more than I would say the first two films. It's kind of at odds with, again, that teen audience that they're trying to cater to. Like, usually if you're making, like, a teen movie, you don't go from making it rated R in the States. It's confusing, but that's par for the course for this film. Salvation is directed by Bharat Naluri, a British Indian film and television director, written by Chip Johannesson, who's worked with Chris Carter a little bit, and also wrote 2000's movie Curiosity Ultraviolet. Ed Pressman and Jeff Most, of course, producing as they do for all of these. Starring, our top billed person here is not actually the person playing the Crow. It's Kirsten Dunst, who was about to have a super breakout year. She was actually working on Virgin Suicides at the same time as she was working on this film, which is kind of insane. Going back and forth between those two must have been crazy. Eric Mabeus plays Alex Corvus. Eric had actually auditioned to play Eric Draven in the original film and also Fun Boy, but was told that he was too young. But with the producers looking to take a younger audience with this film, I guess it makes sense. If it matters, he is our first blonde Crow. He's very boyish looking. I think Eric is a good actor. Like, I can see that he has, like, ideas and, like, talent. I think the deck is incredibly stacked against anyone who is going to be in this film, and I think it's especially stacked against his specialties. I don't love his performance, but again, like, I don't love this movie. Like, it's not his fault. William Atherton plays Aaron and Lauren's father, and Walton Goggins is here. Walton Goggins has been in a variety of weird places, and if you are a character actor follower like I am, you've probably seen him in a lot of stuff. The producers originally intended Salvation to be a Halloween 1999 release, but after very poor test screenings, it was unceremoniously direct-to-video released in January of 2000. It had 1 week of screenings in Spokane, Washington, and it was quickly ushered out of theaters. The critical reception was also not very warm. I think it's at a 19% on Rotten Tomatoes right now, with only a slightly higher audience score, which is not unusual. Usually audience scores are a little higher, but not by much in this case. It pretty quickly left the public imagination, and most people don't even know there are a third and a fourth film. As I do with any piece of media that I examine on this podcast, I always try to look for things that it contributes to the canon going forward, or threads that it has taken from the past and carried with it. Salvation kind of drops the ball on a lot of these, and I think, weirdly, a big part of that is the massive downgrade in production design and costume design and cinematography. There is such a lack of, like, artistic feel for this movie. Like, it was made by weekly television writers and directors, and the scope, scale, and budget very much feel that way. Salt Lake City as a location really does not play into the aesthetics of the film, which, like I kind of get it, but at the same time, did you guys know that Utah is the capital for white-collar crime? Do you know how much crime goes on in Utah? Like, that would have been an interesting thing to play off of. Like, I feel like location has played such a huge part in every Crow story leading up to this, besides maybe Stairway to Heaven, because they were using Vancouver as sort of stand-in Detroit, but they also never really explicitly say that. Salt Lake City is explicitly named, but has nothing to do with, like, the story or the aesthetics. I found the costume design for this one very lacking. A lot of khaki pants, a lot of, like, nobody has a distinct look. Our Crow barely even has a distinct look. The iconic coat attempts to be carried over into this film, but it's like this weird furry collared cop coat thing. Although I do like when Alex ditches the coat post completing his Crow mission but not dying yet, and he has this sort of, like, burnt, ripped up sweater thing that does give Trent Reznor in the Closer video drop stitch knitted sweater vibe, which, like, I love that. I own 2 drop stitch sweaters because I like it so much. I will say that the concept for Alex's makeup is also very, very cool and heretofore unseen. It's actually burns in his face from the electric chair execution he suffered. He wakes up and, like, peels off gross skin and it becomes the makeup. This idea is cool. I wish its execution, ha ha ha, looked a little better. Like the prosthetics when he physically, like, takes the skin off at the start of the film look pretty fake. And the makeup just doesn't hold up as, like, a look throughout the movie. But I do like that it ties into the story, much like the previous 2 films did, what with Ash using his son's paints to do his makeup and Eric having the mask on the vanity and being, like, that iconic, you know, makeup look. But nobody is distinct other than that, and that's also a problem. You can define people by their costumes in the previous films super easily. Everyone has a style. If you're a villain, if you're a good guy, if you're a bystander, you have a look to you. And here, you're either the Crow or wearing khakis. Even Kirsten Dunst's fits don't really do much for me. The production design is also a little lazy, in my opinion, especially with such high standards set before it. even the weird club feels like the upstairs of an office building. And the cinematography is nothing to write home about. Which is disappointing because one of the things that really elevates a Crow movie, even one that might not be amazing, like, I don't think City of Angels is amazing, but its aesthetics and production design is still stunning and clearly had a lot of thought put into it, and Salvation does not. You can usually find the Crow Salvation packaged with the other three Crow sequels, something that a lot of people tell me they find in the $5 bins at Walmart, and this is normally the part in this episode where I would discuss the impact that this movie had on the people who made its careers or, you know, what these people went on to do. Kirsten Dunst obviously has gone on to have an insanely beautiful career, which she was even doing while making this film, Virgin Suicides. I mean, come on. But for the most part, the people who made it don't really talk about it. It does not seem to have much of an impact on their careers. And it was a movie that was just quietly made, quietly released, and quietly fell by the wayside. Which is the first time that's happened for a Crow film. There is one sort of hallmark of Crow movies that Salvation has kept, and that is the stacked soundtrack of alternative bands contributing music to the film. And we will cover that stacked list on next episode's Coda. And until then, that concludes my coverage of The Crow Salvation. It was a weird journey, but I hope you found something interesting within this story. And if you're one of the staunch defenders of Salvation out there, please let me know what you love about this thing. I'd love to hear it from you. But until then, stay safe. I'm eternally grateful for everyone who listens to this show. We've created such a weird, cool little community in the last couple months, and I'm extremely grateful. And until then, I'll see you next time.